And I think you've just received some reading material. The Heart Sutra that we're talking about, and also some explanation of some of the important points contained in the Diamond Sutra, as well as some excerpts from the Diamond Sutra. So, and you've also gotten the review questions, which you can just have a look at, and we will go over them together on Saturday. Now this morning I'll continue with lecture that I was giving last evening, because we haven't yet finished with the presentation of the material relating to the Heart Sutra. Last night when we stopped, I was talking about how the Heart Sutra teaches the identity, or better, the non-differentiation of samsara and nirvana. And I think I referred to a stanza from the Mula Madhyamaka Karika of Nagarjuna, where he says there's not the slightest difference between samsara and nirvana. There's not the least distinction between samsara and nirvana. The limit of samsara is the limit of nirvana, and the limit of nirvana is the limit of samsara. Now, there are many grounds for this assertion. The Heart Sutra does not state this explicitly. Nowhere really does the Heart Sutra say that samsara and nirvana are not different. But the Heart Sutra does say that there is no origination and there is no cessation. And the Heart Sutra does say that there is no suffering, no cause of suffering, no end of suffering, no path, no attainment, no non-attainment, no ignorance, no destruction of ignorance, no old age and death, and no destruction of old age and death. So all of these dualities are negated explicitly by the Heart Sutra. Especially this negation of origination and cessation, or origination and extinction, especially this makes the non-differentiation of samsara and nirvana possible, because samsara is what is originated and what is destroyed. But according to the Heart Sutra, there is no origination, there is no birth. And because there is no birth, there is also no destruction, there is also no extinction. As far as the sutra literature is concerned, the Mahayana Sutra literature is concerned, it employs examples, uses examples to demonstrate the fact that there's no origination, there's no real birth, no real coming into existence, and there's no real passing away, there's no real extinction or death. And yesterday I mentioned the example that we find in the Samadhi Raja Sutra, the example of the dream of the virgin girl who dreams that she has given birth to a son and then dreams that that son dies. So the point there being that there is no real birth and no real death, because birth and death in a dream are not real birth and death. And since this world, this phenomenal world that we experience, is like a dream, so here also there is no real birth and no real destruction. Birth, origination, duration, and destruction are the characteristic marks of the Sanskrita Dharma, the conditioned factors. And the absence of origination, duration, and destruction are the characteristics of the unconditioned factors, the asamskrita dharma, or of nirvana, so to speak. But since there is no real origination, duration, and destruction, there are no characteristic marks of the conditioned factors, and so since there are no conditioned factors, there can't be any unconditioned factors. Since there is no real birth and death, so there is no real absence of birth and death. Now, as I say, in the Mahayana Sutra literature, this point is made with the help of examples. Next term, next time that we meet in January, we will be looking at the Madhyamaka system, which is largely based to a considerable degree based on the Prajnaparamita literature. We'll be looking at the Madhyamaka system of Nagarjuna, and we'll be looking at some of the compositions, some of the writings of Nagarjuna, and there we'll see that there is a logical way also to demonstrate the non-origination of factors. But here in the sutra literature, and this I mentioned to you right at the beginning when I began to talk about the Mahayana sutra literature, I said the sutra literature does not bother with arguments, with logical and systematic reasoning. Sutra literature confines itself to similes and examples and declarations. And this is the case here in the Heart Sutra also. There's no origination, there's no cessation, there's no increase, no decrease. Now that you have the text, and I'll have Mrs. Santina read the Heart Sutra to us all later today. It's a very auspicious thing to have to hear the Heart Sutra in any case, so it will confer blessings upon us all. And there, when you hear it and then when you look it over, you'll be able to see all these declarations of the Heart Sutra to the effect that these various what we take normally as being fundamental truths of Buddhism, ignorance, the extinction of ignorance, birth, old age, death, the extinction of old age and death, and so on and so forth. The Four Noble Truths, suffering, the origin of suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, the path, attainment, non-attainment, all of these things are non-existent. None of these things exist in emptiness. So this is the message of the sutra. This is what the sutra tells us. All of these things are not existent in reality. They don't exist in emptiness. They don't exist because they are interdependent. They're relative. Samsara and nirvana are relative. Ignorance and the destruction of ignorance are relative. Suffering and the end of suffering are relative. The cause and the path, all of these things are relative. Attainment and non-attainment, what is there to attain? Who attains it? All of these things belong to the sphere of the relative. I'll talk about this in more detail later, but I can say at this point also that all of these things, according to the Mahayana, belong to what we call conventional truth, or even more clearly, or even more directly, we call it worldly convention, convention that belongs to the world, loka vyavahara, vyavahara, loka vyavahara. Now, I'm going to digress just a little bit from the text of the sutra now, to talk about some of the similes that the Mahayana commonly uses. And these similes are found, for example, in the Ashtashashrika Prajnaparamita, the Perfection of Wisdom Discourse in 8,000 lines. some of the similes that the Mahayana tradition uses to explain or to indicate the greatness or the importance of the perfection of wisdom, the importance of the Prajnaparamita. So to begin with, we find that the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, is called the mother of all the Tathagatas, the mother of all the Buddhas. In what sense is the perfection of wisdom the mother of all the Buddhas? Because it is through the perfection of wisdom, relying on the perfection of wisdom, that all the enlightened ones, all the Tathagatas, have become perfectly enlightened Buddhas. And in fact, this we do find in the text of the Heart Sutra. Toward the end, it says, it's by relying on the perfection of wisdom that all the Tathagatas have achieved, all the Tathagatas of the three times have achieved, do achieve enlightenment, perfect, supreme enlightenment, through relying on the perfection of wisdom. So you can see here how the perfection of wisdom is of paramount importance, of supreme importance for the Mahayana and for the Mahayana conception of how one attains Buddhahood. I mentioned yesterday that the perfection of wisdom is one of the six perfections, which are the heart, so to speak, of the Bodhisattva path, that lead, that enable living beings to become Buddhas. And in the perfection of wisdom discourses, we also find the Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, likened to a sighted guide. So the other perfections, the perfections of generosity, morality, patience, energy, meditation, these other perfections are like blind men. And a collection of blind men can never reach their destination without the help of a sighted guide. So the perfection of wisdom is like the sighted guide. Perfection of wisdom is like the eyes of the other perfections. The other perfections will never reach Buddhahood. One can practice generosity, morality, and so forth for aeons, countless aeons, but one will never achieve Buddhahood without the perfection of wisdom. And in fact, it is the perfection of wisdom that turns these other practices of generosity, morality, and so forth into perfections, into paramitas. And I will explain how that is, why that is, in a little while, when I look at some of the important teachings of the Diamond Sutra of the Vajracchedika. The texts also say that the perfection of wisdom for a bodhisattva, for one practicing the bodhisattva path, is like the baking of a clay jar. If you leave a clay jar, an earthenware jar, unbaked, it is very fragile. It can break very easily. But once you bake it in an oven, it becomes hard, becomes difficult to break. And in the same way, a bodhisattva who doesn't practice the perfection of wisdom, who doesn't realize the perfection of wisdom, is liable to break. He's subject, he's likely to break, to shatter. But if he practices, understands, realizes the perfection of wisdom, he becomes unbreakable. He becomes strong. So all of these attributes, all of these benefits from practicing the perfection of wisdom, understanding, realizing the perfection of wisdom, all of these are described in the text. Now to return to the actual text of the Heart Sutra, we find here an example of a form of a device, a device that enables us to retain something in our memory. And this sort of device is quite common throughout the Mahayana tradition, and that is the use of what are called dharanis or mantras. Now, the dharani is something that helps us to remember, it helps us to hold on to a teaching. This is the meaning of the term. The meaning of the term is something which helps us to dhara, helps us to hold on to a particular meaning. So we have a number of dharanis in the Mahayana tradition. One very popular one is the Mahakarunika dharani, which is recited very often in China, and which has become popular also in other Buddhist countries. And we have also a number of mantras. Now the mantras, of course, are particularly associated with the Vajrayana tradition, which makes extensive use of mantras, and where we have some very famous mantras, like the one which is very commonly known, Om Mani Padme Hum. But even here in the Mahayana literature, we have some mantras. And this text, the Heart Sutra, refers to the mantra of the perfection of wisdom. Now, I should point out at this point that the use of dharanis is not exclusively a Mahayana phenomenon, that we do have, even in the Pali tradition, a great many paritas which perform the same function as dharanis and which are commonly used by lay people. I've been told, and I've seen scholars affirm, that in most households in Sri Lanka there is a book of dharanis which is kept on the shrine, or rather a book of paritas which is kept on the shrine. So we have a venerable history of the use of paritas in the Theravada tradition also. We have the Atapata parita, which was taught to the Buddha by one of the yakkhas for the protection of the monks and nuns and Buddhist lay people who might be troubled by some yakkhas who were less than well disposed toward Buddhism. So Atanata Parita, I think it's called. So here in this text we're presented with the Prajnaparamita mantra, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom. And I think we have it there on the board. So you please put that on the board. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom, you have it in the text of the sutra. It goes, Tajata Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Svaha. And this we can translate roughly as thus, Om, gone, gone, well gone, very well gone, gone, gone beyond, enlightenment, hail. So It is a mantra which encapsulates the idea behind the perfection of wisdom. That is to say, wisdom gone, gone, gone beyond, gone well beyond, enlightenment, hail. And the sutra tells us that this mantra makes the unequal equal, that this mantra pacifies all sufferings, that this mantra is true and never false, and so forth. So this mantra is said by the sutra to have many, many qualities. So if you can't recite the whole sutra every day, then at least recite this mantra a few times every day, and it will be of great benefit to all of you. So the sutra at this point is drawing to a conclusion. It talks about how this mantra is the going beyond the achievement of enlightenment. At this point, we find the Buddha finally participating in the sutra, comes out of his meditation. He emerges from his meditative concentration to commend Avalokiteshvara on his preaching of the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, of the Heart Sutra. So the Buddha comes out of meditation to say, well said, thus it is that the son or daughter of good family should train themselves in the perfection of wisdom. So the Buddha, at this point, although he has been the sort of behind the scenes, he's been the mover, the instigator of the dialogue, instigator of the question that Sariputra put to Avalokiteshvara. But the Buddha has remained in the background throughout the discourse. Now, just at the end, the Buddha emerges from his meditation in order to praise, in order to commend Avalokiteshvara on his exposition of the perfection of wisdom. Okay, now, I need to... I think it would be well if I now try to put the message of the perfection of wisdom discourse, the heart of the perfection of wisdom discourse, if I try to put it somewhat into context, because we have noted that the perfection of wisdom discourse is primarily occupied with an exposition of emptiness, with the declaration, with the statement that all these various elements of Buddhist doctrine, the avidharmika analysis of reality, the various soteriological or religious categories of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, ignorance, the destruction of ignorance, the destruction of birth, old age and death, the destruction of birth, old age and death, origination, cessation, etc. That all these categories, all these components of Buddhist law, so to speak, of the Dharma that was enunciated by the Buddha at the Deer Park in Varanasi, much of this was expounded already in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, in the first discourse delivered by the Buddha. All of these are in reality empty. All of these in reality do not exist. They do not exist in emptiness. Now, what does the meaning of this declaration, what is the meaning of this declaration? What is the purpose of this declaration? The fundamental purpose of the Heart Sutra, as is the purpose of the Diamond Sutra, which we'll be looking at in a few moments. But the fundamental purpose of the Heart Sutra is...
Sorry.
No problem.
We respect and just one question. Mm-hmm. There's no Dharana or the mantra. Are these being composed during Buddha's time or after?
Well, this, you know, it really depends on what position you want to take. The fact is, I'm answering a question publicly which was asked privately. I personally think that we should abandon our attachment to a linear conception of the development of Buddhism or the evolution of Buddhism. I don't think we should hold on to a linear historical conception of the evolution of Buddhism. I think that Buddhism evolved the image, you know, people like to, and we are the first to be guilty of this, Western scholars, I mean, we like to draw a line from the time of the Buddha, and we like to say that at year zero, this was the teaching, at year 50, this was the teaching, at year 100, this was the teaching, at year 500, this was the teaching, and so forth. I don't think that that is accurate or even fair. I think we are just imposing our own, because it's simpler for us to think of things in terms of one thing following upon another, just as 2 o'clock follows upon 1 o'clock and so on. But if we take a broader view, the image that I think is more appropriate to an understanding, to assist, to help us understand how Buddhism evolved, is the image of a stone being thrown into the center of a pond. If you throw a stone into the center of a pond, you get ripples, you get waves extending from the point of impact, and these waves become wider and wider, and they eventually cover the whole surface of the pond, and there's no real first or second, or there may be a first wave, a second wave, and so forth, but there's no line. In other words, the Buddha, the teaching of the Buddha was like a stone dropped into the pond of human consciousness, of human awareness, and it had ripples, it had waves, it created waves, and these waves manifested in different ways in the different traditions. So in some places you have the manifestation in the form of the Theravada teachings, other places you have a manifestation in the form of the Mahayana teachings. It's not really possible to line these up in a row and say this came first, that came next, and so forth. And it doesn't really matter. What is important is that all of these waves, all of these aspects of the Buddha's teaching were inspired by that initial splash, by that initial impact, by that initial input that the Buddha made with his teaching, with his personality. So I would like to see things in this way, and not so much in a linear way, because I think we've been chasing our own tails for a long time now, trying to pin down the dates of texts and teachings, and it's extremely difficult. And what we need to do is we need to look at texts. After all, again, I said this before and I'll say it again, IBC is an academic institution, but it's not only an academic institution. It's also a spiritual institution. It's also a religious institution. This is why a lot of friends of mine who are practicing Buddhists are not very comfortable in strictly academic institutions. Because strictly academic institutions refuse to regard the Buddha as a supramundane being capable of supramundane feats. Nobody in the School of Oriental and African Studies, or in the School of Oriental Languages in Berkeley, or the Buddhist Studies Department in Wisconsin, or in Harvard, nobody is going to sit and listen to anyone say that the Buddha could speak to disciples in 100 different languages at the same time. Nobody is going to accept that. You're going to be laughed out of the seminar, you know? But we believe that, and there's no reason why we shouldn't. And because they don't believe that, that is just their mindset. It's not, there's no, you know, again, there's no certificate of truth that attaches to a particular point of view. It's just another point of view. So I think that in this kind of context, we can be permitted. We can say that, yes, okay, let us look at the Heart Sutra. Let's analyze the language. Let's see, this particular Sanskrit form was quite common in the second or third century CE. Therefore, probably the sutra was written in the second or third century CE. Now, was it an abridgment of the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines, or did it come first and the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines came later? If the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines came later, then we know that that existed already 100 CE, so then the Heart Sutra must have been earlier than that. And of course, this is very good for academics. I mean, there's a lot of papers to write about this. And there's a lot of PhD dissertations, and there are grants to be had, you know? So it's a kind of self-generating factory. You know, it's a factory that creates its own tasks. But are those our tasks? I mean, are those the things that we should be concerned about? Or should we look at, as the Buddha says in the Lotus Sutra, that all of these teachings, that whatever teachings I give, they're for the purpose of liberation. They're for the purpose of liberation. So why not concentrate on that aspect, you know? Now, I don't want to suggest that you shouldn't ask me questions to the effect, when was the Perfection of Wisdom Mantra written down? You can ask me that kind of question, but don't expect a definite answer from me, because I don't know. And I don't think anybody knows, really, you know? So, I mean, in some ways, it should be put, you know, instead of 14 unanswerable questions, there should be maybe 25 unanswerable questions, you know? Or 25 or 30 or 50 questions that are not conducive to enlightenment. You know, I think we should concentrate on the message of the text, not worry so much about... It's, let me put it this way, it's old. I can give you that much assurance that it's really quite old. You know, it wasn't written in Hollywood 30 years ago. It's an old text and an old teaching that's been venerated for many years. Already, Fa Shen, when he crossed the Gobi Desert, was reciting the Heart Sutra. That's 4th century CE. You know, that's pretty old as far as texts go. You know, what more do we want? What more can we ask? It was only 900 years from the time of the Buddha. You know, it was not very distant from the time of the Buddha. So, okay. Anyway, what I wanted to talk about now was the distinction between conventional truth and ultimate truth, or worldly convention and ultimate truth. And this is something which, again, was not invented by the Mahayana. The Mahayana did not invent the distinction between conventional truth and ultimate truth. In Sanskrit, it's Vyavahara, and in Paramartha. In Pali, and excuse me, those of you who know Pali much better than I do, and I'm sure there are many here who do, but it's Vohara and Paramartha, no? Am I correct? Something like that. So the terms are there in the Pali tradition, the conventional truth and the ultimate truth. The difference is a difference of interpretation. In general, in the Theravada tradition, when people speak in terms of I and mine and objects, that is regarded as the conventional truth. So for example, if I were to say Devadatta is going into his house, that would be a statement made in accordance with the conventional truth, because I'm talking about a person and I'm talking about an object, a unitary object, a house. Or when, for example, even the Buddha on occasion said, I will now go to Uruvelva, that would be a statement made in accordance with conventional truth, because it talks about persons and objects. Again, in general terms, within the Theravada tradition, when you talk in terms of factors, when you talk in terms of dharmas, in terms of skanda, dhatu ayatana, in terms of dhammas, those statements would be in accordance with ultimate truth. That would be a description, a statement, an expression made in agreement, in accord with ultimate truth. So this in general is the definition of the Theravada. More specifically, in the Abhidharma, we have got four ultimate realities. Three conditioned and one unconditioned. Now one of you good Theravada monks will tell me which those four ultimate realities are according to the Abhidharma. Please, the four ultimate realities according to the Abhidharma. Chitta, Chittasika, Rupa, and Nirvana. Exactly. Yeah. These are the four ultimate realities. Three of them are conditioned. Chitta, Chittasika, and Rupa. Is it Rupa? I don't remember. It's matter. We translate it matter in English. I'm not sure what the original term is. Chitta, mind, mental states, matter, and nirvana are the four ultimate realities. Three of them are conditioned. Mind, mental states, and matter are conditioned. Nirvana is unconditioned. Now, what happens in the Mahayana? In the Mahayana teaching is, the Mahayana says, if something is conditioned, it can't be ultimate. Just as interdependent origination and independent existence, pratityasamutpada and svabhava are contradictory. If something is pratityasamutpada, it can't be svabhava, it can't have its own being. Similarly, if something is conditioned, it can't be ultimate, because ultimate things are unconditioned. So from the Mahayana point of view, the only ultimate reality is nirvana. The only ultimate reality is unconditioned. So that's why all of this is conventional. All of these things, the five aggregates, the 18 dhatus, the six ayatanas, the origination, duration, destruction, increase, decrease, old age, ignorance, destruction of ignorance, destruction of old age and death, the Four Noble Truths, all of these are conventional because they're all relative. They all depend upon other things. Now you say, okay, well, if nirvana is the only reality, then I have just talked about how nirvana and samsara are relative. And so in that sense, even nirvana is conditioned, because nirvana doesn't exist by itself. Nirvana exists in opposition to samsara. Basically, what the Mahayana says is that anything that you can put into words is conventional truth, not ultimate truth. Because ultimate truth, ultimate reality, paramartha satya, is inexpressible. It's inconceivable. We call the teaching of the perfection of wisdom that we have here in the Heart Sutra and the teaching of the perfection of wisdom that we have in the Diamond Sutra, we call it ultimate truth. When we say that in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no perception, no volition, no consciousness, in emptiness there is no eye, no ear, no nose, no form, no sound, no smell, no eye consciousness, no ear consciousness, no mind consciousness. When we say that, we call it ultimate truth. Why do we call it ultimate truth? Not because it's really ultimate truth. It's actually part of the conventional truth. But we call it ultimate truth by courtesy. We call it ultimate truth. Why? Because it points to ultimate truth. It's not ultimate truth, but it points to ultimate truth. So for that reason, we refer to this point of view as ultimate truth. It isn't really ultimate truth. Anything that you can put into words, anything that is conceivable, is not ultimate truth. That's why we can say, on the one hand, we can say nirvana is the only ultimate truth, because yesterday someone asked me, how do we define nirvana? We don't define nirvana, because nirvana is undefinable. It's not existent, it's not non-existent, it's not earth, water, fire, air, it's supreme bliss, etc., etc., but then it's none of those things. It's really inexpressible, undefinable. So the ultimate truth is really inexpressible, undefinable. We have certain texts, like the Heart Sutra, like the Diamond Sutra and so forth, that point to the ultimate truth. They point to it. This is not ultimate truth. What this is pointing at is ultimate truth. The Heart Sutra is not ultimate truth. What it's pointing at by saying there's no form, no feeling, etc., that is pointing toward ultimate truth. That's why even shunyata is not ultimate truth. I told you yesterday that there is the emptiness of emptiness. That emptiness is only a corrective for belief in svabhava, for belief in self-existence. So none of this is actually ultimate truth. But we just tag it, we label it ultimate truth, because it points toward ultimate truth. Its objective is ultimate truth. Just like that signboard that says Hat Yai or Penang is not Hat Yai or Penang, but it points to Hat Yai or Penang. So for that reason we call it, you know, the signboard pointing to Hat Yai or Penang. It's something that points to ultimate truth, that is, you know, hints at ultimate truth, is conducive to an understanding of ultimate truth. But so long as it's expressed in words, so long as it can be captured in concepts, it's not ultimate truth. So here we have, I think in the outlines, I think I said something like moving the goalposts. I mean, the Mahayana moves the goalposts. It raises the bar. What is ultimate truth? It's not the skandhas, dharmas, ayatanas, the factors and so forth. It's not that. Ultimate truth is what is inexpressible, what is inconceivable, what we can call, for the sake of convenience, nirvana. That is ultimate truth. That's the only ultimate truth. Nagarjuna says nirvana is the only truth. Everything else is false. So this, all of these methods, all of these paths, all of these training techniques, all of these concepts that we have where we have to get away from bad samsara and achieve good nirvana, all of these things where, all of these are just part of the path, they're just part of conventional truth. They're not ultimate truth. They don't exist in ultimate truth. So the purpose of the Prajnaparamita is to point at ultimate truth, to turn people's minds away, to get them to let go of the raft and to, you know, to look toward ultimate truth, not to hold on to the dharmas, not to hold on to particular formulations, but to turn their minds toward ultimate truth, toward what is beyond existence and non-existence. As the Buddha told Kacchayana, that existence and non-existence are the cause of people remaining in bondage, to turn their minds beyond existence and non-existence, beyond identity and difference, and to look for the really unconditioned. The really unconditioned. What is beyond words and thoughts, words and ideas. And we have some sort of similes here, which appear also in the Diamond Sutra, which are intended to give an idea of what sort of reality we're talking about. And one of the examples, the first of the example, examples is the example of stars. Now, I don't know why the Buddha chose to use stars as an example. It actually is a very appropriate example, because even scientists tell us today, when we observe a star, that star might not even exist any longer, because it takes so long for the light from that star to reach us that we might be observing a star that no longer exists, or it doesn't exist in the form in which we observe it. So the first example is stars. Then we have the example of the lamp. And this again is an example that was used by the Buddha in the Majjhima Nikaya, and I've told you about this example, the example of the flame in an oil lamp. It's not in the oil, it's not in the wick, it's nowhere in between. It has no self-existence, no swabhava. Then there's the example of the magical show, the magical illusion. Again, I talked about this yesterday, the magical illusion. If you don't believe in magic, well, what about the hologram? What about when things appear but there isn't anything really there? What about hallucination? You know, so we have magical appearance. Dewdrops. Dewdrops also, they're there for a moment, they disappear. Bubbles. The Buddha talked about the whole mass of phenomena being like foam, like bubbles. Dream. He talked about dream, how dream, the example of the dream of the virgin girl. So everything is like dream. Lightning, a flash of lightning. It's there for a moment. Clouds are insubstantial. All of these phenomena are conditioned, insubstantial, and empty. That is to say, you can't pin them down. And it's remarkable, and this is an area that is of some personal interest to me, but it is remarkable that 20th century science, quantum physics in particular, has come to the same conclusion, because when they went in search of the atom, they found that the atom was not unitary. And when they went in search of subatomic particles, they found that they couldn't pin them down, that they were like ghosts. And in fact, one of the fathers of 20th century quantum mechanics, Heisenberg, said the whole universe is like a nebulous, a cloudy ghost. We can't pin anything down. There's nothing substantial there. It's all just like a cloud, just like a mist. You know, so it is remarkable that what the Buddha and the great Buddhist masters understood through meditation and understood through their profound examination of reality, their profound consideration of what was real, how things really were, that they arrived at conclusions that 20th century science has arrived at in the laboratory, using the techniques of experimental science. And the conclusions are astonishingly similar. Okay, so I think that I have, at this point, I think I have finished with the Heart Sutra and with lecture number 5. And if you have any questions, perhaps we can take a few moments to deal with those before I...
After questions.
Questions?
If
you... What?
No.
Now or at the end of the lecture?
What
I was suggesting we could take a break for questions now, because I'm going to take up the Diamond Sutra. So if you ask me some questions, that will also give me a little time to catch my breath.
Excuse me, sir. Could you explain...
Yes, actually I'm very glad that you asked me that question, because I should have talked about that, and I neglected to talk about that. It occurred to me this morning, but we were not at that point in the text, so it was difficult for me to retrace my steps and talk about it. This is very significant, this statement that form is emptiness, emptiness is form, is extremely important, because what it shows is that emptiness is not different from the phenomenal world. That we don't have the phenomenal world here and emptiness somewhere else. The phenomenal world and emptiness are actually one and the same thing. So this cup is at the same time a cup. It's also Rupa Skanda, incidentally, because it's form. It is also emptiness. So its emptiness is part of its form. This is also one route to the non-differentiation of samsara and nirvana. Because emptiness and form and emptiness and feeling are not different, so therefore nirvana and samsara are not different. What we find in this world and what is its actual nature, which is emptiness, these are identical. So it isn't that emptiness is one thing, form is another thing. The real nature of form is emptiness. This is why it's also said that everything that is interdependently originated is also empty. So what is interdependently originated, on the one hand, it appears in the form of cups and living beings and bridges and houses and so forth, but at the same time, because they are all interdependently originated, they don't have any self-existence, so they're also empty. So the idea there between of the identification or the non-difference of emptiness and form is just to underline the fact that emptiness is not something different from all of these appearances. All of these appearances are in fact emptiness, and emptiness also is all of these appearances. These appearances, because they appear, they don't cease to be empty. They are empty because they are conditioned, because they're fleeting, because they're impermanent, because they depend on other things. So emptiness and form and emptiness are identical, and there is no duality. There's no separation between the phenomenal world and emptiness. Emptiness is the nature of the phenomenal world. Somewhere in one of the Mahayana texts, it says, the nature of sugar is sweet, the nature of salt is to be salty, the nature of all phenomena is empty. So emptiness is the nature of all phenomena. The phenomena appear, their appearance does not block or negate their emptiness. They are at the same time empty, and at the same time they appear. Because what is emptiness? Think for a moment again about how we talked about emptiness. Emptiness is beyond existence and non-existence. This is actually, you know, I talked about emptiness, how emptiness is used. Emptiness is used to correct the mistaken belief in the self-existence of things. But emptiness is actually the transcending, the going beyond the basic views of existence and non-existence. So what do we say? I went over this yesterday, but of course I realized that we touched on a lot of topics yesterday, so it's not surprising that we weren't able to follow everything. But yesterday I said, you know, the world exists. We can't deny that there's, the world exists in some fashion. We experience it. So it's not non-existent. But at the same time, because it doesn't have any permanent state of being, because it's changeable, because it's conditioned, because it will disappear, we can't also say that it exists. So it's beyond existence and non-existence. So that's why this cup is empty, because it exists, because for the moment it's here. We can see it, we can hold it, we can use it. But it doesn't exist ultimately, because it is going to disappear. One day it will break, it will get swept into the dustbin, the pieces will go back to the earth, etc., etc. So it's not existent in an ultimate or permanent sense. So it's beyond existence and non-existence, and that's why it's empty. So its nature is emptiness, even though it appears as a form.
So, Doctor, would you say that it's a metaphysical situation?
I don't really like the term metaphysical particularly. What do you mean by that? I mean, why metaphysical?
Is it the principle of metaphysics? The idea of emptiness?
I don't think so. I think it's just the way things are. I mean, the fact is that things come into existence and things go out of existence. And so because of that, they're not really existent, and they're also not non-existent. And so we just put this label emptiness on that as a kind of convenient device. I mean, we could call it other things. We could invent some other name for it. I mean, it's just the name for the conditioned existence of phenomena, for the interdependent existence of phenomena. We call it emptiness because it doesn't have any own being, it doesn't have any svabhava, it doesn't have any independent existence of its own. So we call this fact of it not having any independent existence, of it not being really existent, nor really non-existent, we call that its emptiness. I wouldn't regard it as a metaphysical principle. I mean, if you like to call it a metaphysical principle, I suppose you can be free to do so, but I don't think it's a metaphysical principle, because once you've realized that, then you can discard emptiness. Metaphysical principles normally you don't discard. I mean, emptiness is also a raft. Emptiness is also to get over attachment to existence and non-existence. When you get over attachment to existence and non-existence, when you get over attachment to independently existing phenomena, then you certainly should throw away emptiness. It's a completely nonsensical to hold on to emptiness after it's done its work. So in that sense, I really don't think that we can call it a metaphysical principle, since it's provisional. It's not something that one should hold on to. Yeah. I mean, impermanent, we have to put a little qualification on impermanent, because impermanent is also one end of a duality. Permanent and impermanent are dualities. Of course, impermanence is a way to get into emptiness, but when you get into emptiness, then you realize that things are neither permanent nor impermanent also. But certainly it is a specifically and precisely, we say that emptiness is a conventional, provisional designation for the interdependence of things, that it is equivalent, that it is the middle way taught by the Buddha. So emptiness is just an expression, it's just a designation for the interdependence, the conditionality of things. That's what emptiness is. Just a convenient name, a designation, a term for the mutually conditioned nature of things. Well, it is expedient means, you see, because we have to. You can't throw away the raft before you have crossed the river. After you cross the river, you have to throw away the raft, or you should throw away the raft. Now, the problem arises, and this always arises whenever we take up the teaching of emptiness, and whenever we teach emptiness to our students, the problem always arises because people tend to jump from the conventional to the ultimate, and they tend to abandon the raft prematurely. They think, oh, everything is emptiness, so we don't have to bother with our practices, we don't have to bother with our meditations, we don't have to bother with good conduct, etc., etc. That's not the way it is. The way it is that at the end of the road, at the end of the day, to achieve liberation and Buddhahood, at that point, you have to develop an understanding of emptiness, and that's the point at which you abandon the practices, and where it no longer means anything to talk about joy. It no longer means anything to talk about suffering, because you've crossed over to a realm where these relative terms have no longer any meaning. So, of course, there's going to be a little bit of confusion here. There's going to be a little bit of fear. There's going to be a little bit of consternation. It's said many, many places in the Mahayana literature that people, when they first hear about emptiness, are frightened by it. They feel uncomfortable. They are afraid of it, and that is because it requires that we abandon our conventional ideas. But it doesn't require that we abandon them right away. You know, what use we can make of emptiness now, as I told you yesterday, is to use it like salt. Use a little bit of it. So, you know, when you practice, for example, giving, just reflect for a moment upon the emptiness of the giver, the gift, and the object. And that will prevent you from becoming attached, from creating this attachment to your practice of giving, to your practice of generosity. The problem is we get attached to even virtuous actions. We think, ah, I'm such a virtuous person. I have given this gift to so-and-so. And we think of all of these participants in the act of giving, the giver, the gift, the action, we think of them all as real. And so instead of getting liberated, yes, we may be reborn wealthy, but we don't get liberation because we're thinking of these things as real. I mean, similarly with the practice of moral conduct, you might practice moral conduct and you become proud because you're practicing moral conduct, and you think of your practice and the moral conduct and all of this as being something solid, something real. We have a habit of getting attached to things, of holding on to things. And as we hold on to things, then we are practicing religion, but we're still materialistic people. We're still looking at the religious practices as things to collect, things to acquire. I'm acquiring, I'm collecting my religious practice, my merit. And as long as we go on collecting things, we're not getting away from I and mine, because I am collecting this merit. I am collecting this moral conduct. I am collecting this meditation experience. So we still have the I and the mind. We still have the I and we have the meditation experience that is mine, my meditation experience, my moral conduct, my practice of generosity. So the purpose of remembering emptiness and remembering that these things are only interdependent and don't have any real existence, that they're like shadows, like clouds, like dewdrops, stars, and so forth. The purpose of remembering that is so that we don't hold on to these practices. We don't regard these practices as belonging to me, belonging to a person. We don't regard these virtues as being substantial and being possessions that we have. The whole point here is to avoid what one writer called spiritual materialism. In other words, turning spiritual practice into just another form of acquisition and just contributing to the construction of an even more deeply rooted ego, only thing, an ego that has a little bit of spiritual polish, a little bit of gold paint, a little bit of ornaments of morality and knowledge of the sutras and so forth. So the point of emptiness is to avoid this kind of building up in the clothes, in the costume of religious practice, perpetuating and continuing to build up this I and mine habit. Now, I don't know whether that helps at all, or you know whether. I mean, you can't. I mean, I wish. I mean, if I were the Buddha, even the Buddha, sometimes people didn't like what he said or didn't understand what he said. So obviously, it's not possible for me to satisfy everyone immediately. But I just say, just think about it and reflect upon it, and then see whether it makes sense. Of course, you can come back to me with questions, and I will do my best to answer them. I don't know whether what I said was of any help. Yes.
Regarding the two truths, some scholars they mention three truths. One,
yes.
One for Samyutti Sacca.
Yes.
And two for Paramatta Sacca. Sangata Paramatta and Asangata Paramatta. And they refer Skanda, Chitta, like those terms into Sangata Paramatta. And then Nibbana for Asangata Paramatta.
I see. So this is a Pali Pali category classification, right? I'm not familiar with this. We have three truths in the Mahayana also, but they're different. In the Mahayana, according to
the Paramatta, Chitta, Chaitasika, Rupa is conditioned and unconditioned.
Yes, they categorize death into a conditioned Paramatta. And Nirvana under the unconditioned
Paramatta. Yeah, well, I mentioned that. Yeah. Of course. I mean that's true. But in the from the Prajnaparamita point of view, all these three.
Samriddhi and Vyavahara, they are the same down there.
Yes, but the point.
There's conviction.
Certainly, we can subdivide. When you mentioned three truths, I thought you were referring that one. One school of the Mahayana, the Yogacara school, they have two kinds of samvritti, a mitya samvritti and a satya samvritti. So, you know, there are ways of subdividing this. As far as the conditioned ultimate and the unconditioned ultimate division in the scheme of the Abhidharma, I'm aware of that. But what I said and what the Mahayana would I think assert is that you can't have a conditioned ultimate. That it's a contradiction in terms to be conditioned and to be ultimate also. Step by step, or no, you practice them all together. Not. I mean, you should practice them all together. Of course, we try in practice. There's no particular order. Let me put it that way. I mean, you're not going to practice generosity and not practice morality or patience or energy and so forth. Obviously, for lay people and for people who don't have a lot of time, the perfections that are easiest to practice are morality, generosity, morality, and patience, and to some extent energy. For those people who have more time and who are more serious practitioners, then they will devote more time to the practices of meditation and wisdom. So in that sense, there is a certain what shall I say, according to the ability, according to the situation of the person practicing, may find it easier to practice the first half, the first three paramitas, may be more easy for him to practice at the beginning than the others. But that is not a hard and fast rule, in the sense that it's also possible for lay people to practice meditation and wisdom. But really, you need to practice some of the perfection of wisdom, even to make generosity into a perfection. This is what I've been hinting at, and which, of course, we will actually talk about in some detail in the next part of the course, in the second part of the course in January. The perfection of wisdom discourses hint at it, the Diamond Sutra hints at it. Basically, if you practice generosity without understanding the emptiness, what I was saying to the lady just a moment ago, if you practice generosity without understanding the emptiness of the giver, the gift, and the action of giving, if you or the recipient in all three or all four, if you practice any of the perfections without an understanding of the emptiness of subject, object, and action, then it's not a perfection. It's just a virtuous action. So you can practice generosity, morality, patience, energy, meditation for aeons. You can practice all you want. You'll never get liberation. You'll just become a very meritorious person and you'll have very good rebirths. In order to get liberation and enlightenment, you have to develop the perfection of wisdom, because that's what's going to free you. Otherwise, you just build up a heap of merit as high as Sumeru, but you don't get free. Well, you have to do it simultaneously. I mean, you cannot, obviously, if you can perfect the perfection of wisdom, that's excellent. A lot of people have difficulty with the perfection of wisdom. It's one of the more difficult ones. So you do what you can, as much as you can, a little bit at a time. You know, I don't think that it's wise or it's useful to prioritize exclusively and say, well, I'm just going to practice the perfection of wisdom. I think you use this, as I said yesterday, you reflect upon it, you bring it, try to integrate it into the whole of your practice. Don't think you should practice these things in isolation. I think you should practice these things, you know, together. I think that's the way they're meant to be practiced, and I think that's the best way to practice them. Otherwise, again, we fall into the trap of isolating things, you know, too much, you know, and we run the risk of actually malpractice or practicing wrongly. Because suppose, just to take an extreme example, suppose you're going to practice the perfection of generosity, but you're not going to practice the perfection of morality. So then you can go out and steal money from a bank and give it to people, no? And you're practicing the perfection of generosity, but for the time being you're not practicing the perfection of morality. Or otherwise you want to practice the perfection of wisdom, but you don't practice the perfection of patience. So you want to sit quietly and meditate on wisdom and develop the perfection of wisdom. So whenever anyone asks you a question, you shout at them and beat them and drive them away. You know, you cannot practice these things in isolation. I mean, they have to go together. They have to go hand in hand. They're a group of travelers that travel together with the help of the eyes of the perfection of wisdom.
Karuna and Panya, they should go hand in hand.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with you entirely. That's absolutely right. Balance, you know, practice of the correct practice of Buddhism is to practice in a balanced way. I mean, not to go to one extreme or another, to keep to balance things. I mean, compassion, wisdom, faith, wisdom, morality, meditation, all of these things should support each other. But your point about wisdom and compassion is absolutely correct. I mean, this is a point which is fundamental and which is extremely important.